You're listening to the latest episode of Professional Builders Podcast. Last month, we spoke to Will Swan, Director of Energy House Laboratories at the University of Salford, about the Energy House 2.0 experiment. In this edition, we hear from Tom Cox, Construction Solutions Director at Saint-Gobain, about his company's involvement in this pioneering project. Tom explains how Saint-Gobain is addressing the industry's sustainability challenges with products like its Weberwall lightweight brick system. The latest issue of Professional Builder magazine is now available at your local builder's merchant trade counter. You can view a digital flipbook version of the current and previous print editions at probuildermag.co.uk, where you can also sign up to receive every edition via email. The Energy House 2.0 site features two detached houses enclosed in environmental chambers under temperature-controlled conditions, where they are subject to rigorous testing. Tom Cox explains Saint-Gobain's involvement in the eHome 2 property to Professional Builders Ed Kelly. If that's not enough, then we also take a look at a time-saving and safety-conscious innovation from Bosch Professional Accessories, the X-Lock disc-changing system for grinders.
My name's Tom Cox. I'm the Construction Solutions Director for Saint-Gobain in the UK and Ireland.
So today we're going to talk about a bit about Weberwall, which is something it was used. So, you know, like I mentioned to you, we've already spoken with the University of Salford a bit about the Energy House 2 project. And I know there's two homes within that. And Saint-Gobain had, you know, had a big hand in the eHome 2. So would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, no, of course. So eHome 2 is a project that Saint-Gobain's driven. They're the principal sponsor for the project. And we partnered with Barratt. And it's a great partnership because Barratt effectively gave us one of their standard house types, which is a Mosby house type, and effectively allowed us to completely build a concept product. So it's really, right, this is a house type that we deliver approximately 1,000 units a year. You, as Saint-Gobain, have a look at how we can build that in a different way, how we can approach the thought process and the performance requirements that future homes are starting to adapt and apply, and how we can do it within a more sustainable building model. So it was a lovely, lovely little pilot project for someone who can't always really push the boundaries in an active site, because in an active site, you're always looking at warranty, supply, mortgageability. This is a house we're building in a lab. We don't have to get a financial drawdown on. So building warrant wasn't really required. Mortgage ties weren't really required. It was just a case of ensuring that the product complied with building regulation and making sure that the concept can come together in a way where you really sort of change the mindset of how you're delivering it. It's more focused on delivering a product, which is the house, and designing that house around the outcomes you want. So the performance outcomes, but also focusing it around the end user and what they want from it, and then reverse engineering it back to make it work at a element component level. And yeah. Weberwall was a big part of that. One of the big drivers around sustainability was removing raw resource used. So if we look at the Weberwall product, you're pretty much looking at about 5 mil of product in terms of a brick slip applied to a 12.5 mil carrier board and bonded using traditional products that you'd see in the render market. And one of the big tellers that I saw on site was when the two houses, obviously the chamber was worked very well in terms of a combined project. When the Bellway house next door uses a traditional brick skin, we used a brick slip brick skin. And when the two deliveries came in to apply the fabrics, see, the brick skin came in 26 pallets, so a full Arctic load of bricks. The Weberwall system with the render board and the components effectively came in the back of a transit van. So you're looking at the difference in terms of sheer quantity. We had a pallet of backing board, which was British Gypsum Glassrock X, and then half a pallet of render for the first floor, half a pallet of brick slip, which was the Weberwall system for the ground floor. And the product went up very, very quickly. So you've got 26 pallets one side and a skilled trade spending 2 weeks putting that product up. On this side, we have one pallet and two half pallets of product and a semi-skilled trade taking 3 days to wrap the whole house and create a watertight finish that you see in the Energy House today. So you've got those real productivity gains in terms of labor the extent of labour required and the time the labour is required. And obviously, we all know about labour shortages in the UK, specifically in the bricklaying sector, where the average age of bricklayers is going up, the amount of people going into the trades going down, and the equation doesn't work. We're addressing that side of things. But at the same time, you're looking at the embodied carbon that's in there by the sheer reduction in material volume. And it's not only the reduction in material volume based on creating the fabric wrap, it's the reduction in volume because you're reducing the loading on the foundations as well. So it's not just removing a quite carbon heavy product, it's removing the structure that's required to carry that. So we are shallower footings, we're less concrete in the footings to carry the weight of the house above, and obviously reducing the raw material content in the like for like finish.
And like you said as well, you know, the difference between one pallet and 26 means that, you know, if you're a builder out on site and you want to start using that, maybe that's going to, that along with the time benefits and stuff like that, it's not just good for the environment, but like you said, you know, the people actually handling the products are going to much prefer that, I think, to unloading 26 pallets worth of bricks and stuff.
From a visual takeaway, you know, that it's a very big teller if you put those two quantities of materials next to each other.
Yeah,
it's a lot. And then obviously you've got the mortar deliveries for the traditional product as well. But, you know, bricks and mortar is a traditional way that we've always built in the UK. It's a big mindset change for people to look at different ways of wrapping buildings. But it's commonplace throughout Europe. The Glasrock X board, which is the carrier board that goes on the outside of a timber frame to basically carry the weather wall and render systems, it's a product that we've had in the Nordics for decades. It's a product that's always been used as an external house wrap, and it's managed to eventually find its way across to the UK, and it's proving to be quite popular, both in medium-rise metal frame buildings, but also now as a wrap to carry finished products in low-rise timber frame or other framed buildings. So it's more considering, as I mentioned, to start with, the balanced approach of how these products all come together. There's no one silver bullet. But what we found when we looked at Energy House was everything we've specified and used is openly available. The only thing that's really changed is how it's applied, how it's designed, and how it's balanced out with other key products within the design forum. And for me, that is really core around balancing and understanding the right fabric, working and balancing with the right mechanical and electrical systems for the future. So really getting an understanding of what sort of sources or electrified sources are you going to create hot water and heating systems with, and what size do they need to be, and then really get into grips around the location and orientation and how that influences design. So on top of that, there's a glazing piece which is really, really interesting going forward. So looking at double glazing, triple glazing, or a mix, so getting away from that one size fits all, because it makes sense from a supply chain, but there's huge benefits for the end users if you're able to design glazing in a way which is around the occupant and the user rather than the delivery and the supply chain. But no, Weatherwall for us saw immense gains, and we're currently just finishing off a complete building life cycle analysis where we'll be able to start to look at and qualify different comparable building models to see how much concrete was removed from the footing, how much we reduce the removal and excavation of land beneath or soil beneath to reduce the depth of the footings and the knock-on effects of using a lighter weight product, not just on the product itself. So it's the connected and associated savings.
Brilliant. That's really, really good. Are there any other products you want to highlight as well?
Yeah, I mean, the whole fabric was produced and thought of in a different way. So the structure of a building, the wall panels, were made from a product called Thermostud. It was a product which specifically came from that project. Again, it was a product that we'd been thinking about looking and using for years, but we just hadn't been able to pilot it on an active site, which resulted in a building that was mortgageable because it's a bit of a minefield to get through that. It's almost chicken and egg. You know, warranty providers want to see that the product you're developing works. You can't prove that the material, that the products work until you've built it, but you can't build it without a warranty. So it's a bit of one of those. So the panel that we put up was, let's say, Thermostud, and we used eye studs in the walls. So reducing the amount of virgin timber material using a OSB spacer. So these eye studs are used, or eye joists are used in commonplace in floors. All we've done is taken that and put in the vertical plane. We've reduced the timber bridging fraction in the panel, which means we can use a more sustainable mineral wool product to insulate the panel to very low levels. So the eye stud that we put in there had a calculated theoretical value of 0.13 in terms of U value. So very, very low. I mean, typically passive would, you can build to passive at 0.15, depending on how you balance a house out. So we're at or below that level, and it's completely closed. So OSB front and back, it has the VCL on the internal face with a service void, a breather membrane on the external face to which battens are applied, and then obviously the Weber wall and the Weber products are applied on the outside. So it's a complete through wall solution effectively, but it's a through wall solution for which Saint-Gobain as a supplier can supply the whole product base. So in terms of the ability to test known with around known products, known build-ups and known delivery models, extends that ability to work with clients to say, we're manufacturing this in a controlled environment. It's coming to site as a closed panel with the VCLs and the breather membranes already attached. You can build a house pretty much in a day in terms of the ground floor in a couple of hours. The floor cassettes will go in a couple of hours, first floor in a couple of hours, and then just top it out. But you get a fabric which is insulated, watertight, with the air tightness membrane already pre-applied. So straight away, internal trades and external trades can start working together. There's no sequencing where you can't overlap those trades. And the benefits when you've got a properly sequenced build around a real value-added product can be seen. It's sort of chalk and cheese. And the client, Barrett, when we were working with them, obviously they've invested quite heavily into timber frame, just saw the benefit of closing that panel and working more efficiently and taking the right products off-site. It doesn't have to be everything. It's just balancing again and getting the right approach for the right developer. So the wall panel was a real good innovation from our side. And that has now, like I say, been rolled out as the thermostud system from Scott Frame. It's openly available. It's got NHBC accepts. It's had an awful lot of testing done around it. And we're starting to extend the scope of offer to include all the other products around it. Cassette systems went in there for the first floor. So it's a floor cassette. So again, very quick, pre-assembled offsite. But they were applied using a posi joist. So it's an open web joist, which was, we couldn't have done what we did in the energy house without using that open web joist, because it did have, because of the nature of the R&D going in there, there were three heating systems, two hot water systems, two ventilation systems. There was a full building management system in there, which was hardwired, called Loxon. And to have that open serviceable space in the floor cassette, just, it was godsend. And then obviously with the service void on the internal walls, extended that service zone for into the cassette onto the walls, and enabled you to put surfaces anywhere without breaking the primary air tightness layer. And then on top, we were looking at how we could house the MEP or the mechanical and electrical equipment for the future without really affecting saleable floor space and affecting land value. And every single house we tend to build in the UK has this massive big fresh air triangle on the roof, which, if utilized properly, specified properly, could become a location to host utilities without impacting the usable area on the floor. So yeah, there was a lot going on. Everything from a slab up was supplied, specified and designed by Saint-Gobain, and obviously worked very closely with the Barrett design team around the house type they supplied. And then the Barrett site manager delivered it. He was a very astute site manager, but we just said, look, deliver it as you would deliver it on site with the commercial pressures that you get on site. Don't give it any special measures. And, you know, we've tried to design the systems and the products around delivering gains on site, which you don't have to consider. And we've just had the first report published through Salford,
yeah,
and it has performed really well. So as a product, and I keep driving the industry, it does really need to get away from the thinking of siloed product component applications, building regulation applications, into No, we are designing a product. And first and foremost, we want a product that works and performs for the end user and delivers benefit to the end user. And then we reverse engineer past all those stages. So as a product, the primary test the university carried out for us was the heat loss coefficient, which is a global performance or measure of a global thermal performance, and air tightness. And to me, they are two primary measurements that a house as a product can be measured at to say all of these components have come together and as an end product performs within a range, an acceptable range from the theoretical design. But we had some massive learnings from some of the individual elements. So as a product it tested, we exceeded the air tightness requirement. We designed to 3 and we got 2.8, and the heat loss coefficient was within 3.8% of the designed value, which isn't far off white noise for equipment and very close compared to some field tests we've seen in the past, which could be up to 140% worse performing than the theoretical, which I don't know if they'd done it without windows in, but that's quite a poor performing house. But again, because it's an R&D product, we wanted to learn how we can do things better. And we did find pockets where in the wall panels, the insulation had been compressed in the manufacturing process, and the knock-on effect of that point U value in that foot section meant we saw drop-offs up to 40% underperforming in spot areas. So for us, it's massive learning to really look at the QC point in that part of the factory to ensure that before that panel's closed, there has to be a visual check and going forward a digital record of that being closed and full, and the insulation being installed as it should be. So, you know, it's a project which not only sets the boundaries around how we should be thinking and designing products, which are houses, but also enhancing the way in which those elements and components come together to give a better performing and more robust product. It's a really good project. And I say we've worked with the university for over a decade, starting in Energy House 1, looking at retrofits and stage retrofits, and now working in partnership with Barratt and Bellway in Energy House 2, which I thought it'd be quite hard work having two big house builders in the same chamber, but it's been quite a collaborative and well thought through complementary project. From my side, obviously, like I say, it's all about understanding route to market and understanding how we can build houses using a more sustainable approach in a productive way, which works for manufacturing as well as site as well as end user. And there's still quite a bit of learning to be done there. I mean, panels and platforms seem to be the right way. It's almost the middle ground where you can create a productive factory environment around a level or manufacturing range. But there needs to still be a bit of a realization in the market that a degree of standardization needs to be met to be able to manufacture products in a factory environment in a productive way, or you're pretty much just taking the problems you experience on site, off site, and adding an extra layer of cost. So it's understanding, and I know the Department of Leveling Up starting to look at kitted parts. So there's a big project on at the moment looking at creating a standardized kit of parts to elevate that piece of houses. Although could be formed from standardized parts, aren't always standardized and all look the same. We don't want to create Legoland. What we do want to do is create a degree of standardization which works for productivity, but also allows for architectural license and aesthetic license. So it's just starting to look at how those that works, looking at analogies from other sectors, understanding how digitization of the sector and data enhances productivity and allows us to start to create more of a circular construction environment rather than where we tend to sit at the moment, which is quite analog and very linear, and really starting to really understand the connection between the end user and the building, and not focus as we tend to do a lot on the very small part of the building, which is the physical delivery of the components to form a house. That's the tiniest part of a building's life cycle. There's an awful lot of focus put on that. There's not much focus on optimization of design and designing around usability, and hardly anything at this point in time around the end of life piece. So how do we recycle or potentially reuse components of that house at the end of its serviceable life? And that's one thing we did look at with this. So the panels were all screwed together. So I don't know if Will Swan mentioned, but his grey matter has been working, as academics always do. And and he's saying it'd be brilliant to have a project to actively measure a deconstruction program. So how do these sorts of houses come apart? How can components be brought down to parts that are recyclable? Or how can panels, for instance, which are probably perfectly serviceable at the end of life, can be repurposed into other applications? And again, that one final piece is around designing in the whole, considering the building as a whole, and considering what's going to be in those buildings going forward. And one big learning thing we saw is getting the fabric performance balanced with the mechanical and electrical performance, with all of the plethora of new MEP kit in there. I mean, we've been quite a privileged situation in the last decade or so, because we effectively build a fabric to a known performance, plonk a combi boiler in, and it's done. The second that combi boiler's disappeared, you're starting to have to consider air source heat pumps and ventilation systems and hot water tanks and battery storage systems and PV systems. It becomes quite a complicated ecosystem to design in, but even more complicated for the end user to move in and start to use. And you can almost imagine, you know, if you buy a new house and you almost have to have a free iPad with it, because there's probably 12 different apps to run all these different pieces of MEP. And as the design is today, all of those MEP sections within apps are siloed. But it's been designed to work together as a system. So one of the big pieces that we did apply, and it was an interesting exercise, was to look at a version of a building management system which works in residential buildings, and how we connect all of those devices into a single interface for a client to use. So a simple log on, I want this room at this temperature on that day with this level of hot water, and then everything else is connected.
Yeah.
So it automatically monitors air quality and heat and hot water and PV optimization. And then that opens up so much opportunity around grid optimization, energy flexible grids at the house level. So you can start to pull in the benefit of a car battery into your house to look at that bi-directional use of energy. But it all comes together as a product, and it all starts from design to get the right balance between the right fabric, the right delivery model, the right MEP package based on the location, orientation, the glazing spec. So there's some really big challenges starting to come in. And as we drive towards the Future Homes Standards, we are going to have to start to understand and accept that houses will be designed and delivered with a very different level of design thinking. And it's not just a combination of components to meet building regulations, and the output is the output you get. It's design around what the output needs to be, and then reverse engineer back.
Do you have an opinion on how we can make our housing stock more energy efficient and fit for a sustainable future? We want tradespeople to be heard, so get in touch. Just open up Voice Memo on your phone and let us know your thoughts. Then send it to pb@hamerville.co.uk. Now, in our sponsored content, Paul Stevenson, Key Account Director at Bosch Professional Accessories, talks us through the features and benefits of the company's X-Lock. Described as the ultimate changing system for angle grinders, it allows safe and tool-free disc changing in seconds.
Yeah, X-Lock, really. With traditional angle grinders, when you're changing a disc, it becomes very difficult and time-consuming. You need a spanner to undo the nut. Also, you can never find that spanner. You can lose it. Also, the actual locking on the actual angle grinder become hot. So when you come to touch, you can obviously burn your fingers, which is a safety issue. And it can be tight and hard to remove. So when you use an angle grinder, once you come to remove the actual locking nut, it does require a bit of a force with the actual spanner. So all these reasons, really, is one of the main topics that Bosch looked into this tool-free system. So they looked into ways that could improve the user interface for the construction worker, and this is where X-Lock came about, really. And the actual mechanism itself actually originated the idea from an engineer at Bosch that was a keen skier. And when you put your your boots into a skid has like this clicking system, and that's where the actual idea came from. So it is really a tool-free accessory change.
So what are some of the advantages to tradespeople in terms of productivity and speed on site?
Well, when you're changing a traditional angle grinder disc, depending if you can find your spanner, for starters, which is always usually in the toolbox in the van outside, it can take a minute plus to change a disc, and time is money on a job. And with the advantage of X-Lock is that you can do it there and then. So all you have to do is pull the lever on the top of the machine, it releases a disc, you can then select your other grinding or cutting disc, and then within 5 seconds, change the disc. So literally it's a less than 5 second disc change. So for a user on site, whether he's lending his grinder to his friends or to his work colleagues, it's a quick time, not consuming grinder change. And that's one of the main advantages of X-Lock.
So in terms of safety then, how does it enhance on-site safety?
One of them with cutting, you can only mount the disc in one direction. So with a traditional angle grinder disc, you can actually mount it the wrong way without knowing. There's an actual direction of rotation on the disc itself. And if you do mount that the wrong way, for instance, on a diamond blade, you can actually cut backwards, which will still work, but you will not get the efficiency of the disc and on the job. With an X-Lock disc, you can only mount it one way. So when you go to actually mount the disc, you'll clearly find out that it will only click in one direction. It's usually the picture side facing up. So that's one of the main safety features of it. In terms of other safety features, it's got an X-brake and drop control on all our grinders. So when you actually let go of the machine, in terms of the trigger, the disc stops instantaneously. If you drop the grinder, it's got like a chip inside the grinder itself, which will automatically stop the grinder from spinning round. Because obviously if you're up a ladder and your colleague's holding the ladder below, if you drop a traditional angle grinder, that can still be rotating when it's hitting the floor. It's got kickback control. So when you're actually cutting, say, into steel, they are notoriously renowned for kicking back, because if you've got two materials pinching the blade, it can kick back, which is obviously dangerous. Our machines have got this again. It's got a sensor in there which determines the acceleration change, and instantaneously it will switch it off straight away. And it just really ensures the disc is securely fastened. Again, with a standard angle grinder, when you've come to actually fasten the disc, if you don't tighten the disc up because you have to hold the spindle lock and then use your old pin spanner, if that's not securely fastened and it is slightly loose, if you start switching that grinder on, the locking up can become loose, and then obviously the disc could then potentially come off the machine at 13,000 RPM. Nobody wants to be in the vicinity of one of those flying off the grinder.
So do X-Lock discs, do they fit on any Bosch angle grinder then, do they?
All X-Lock discs are backwards compatible. So you can take a standard X-Lock disc and you can put it on any manufacturer's 4.5-inch or 5-inch machine. Obviously, you can't put a standard angle grinder disc on an X-Lock machine, but all X-Lock discs are backwards compatible. So whether you have competitor A, B or C, if you buy into the X-Lock system, you can then use it on your standard angle grinders. And then when your angle grinder needs replacing, you can then obviously upgrade to an X-Lock grinder and then still utilize your discs.
From a tradesperson point of view, from the end user perspective, how do they know that the disc is actually secured and in place then?
So on an angle grinder, on the X-Lock angle grinder, there's a red lever on the top, which is like a rectangle shape, and you pull that back to make sure it's disengaged. You flip then the angle grinder round on its back. You then place a disc. You literally locate it onto the actual fitment, push it down, and once you push it down, you'll hear a really nice click or a snap noise. You can actually see the mechanism lock into place, and then you know it's locked. It's really quite a loud click. So if you don't hear that, you'll know it's not locked, and you'll know straight away, because it's either loose where you can pick it up with your hand, or it's physically locked to the machine. And then to release the disc, all you do is flip the machine round again, pull the red lever on the top, and then it will release the disc. And we also have another safety feature, is that when the machine is running, the actual mechanism disengages, so you cannot actually physically release the disc when the disc is spinning.
So does X-Lock improve the quality of the finish then? Does it make up for a better angle grinder?
On cutting, I would say no, because cutting is, the X-Lock just speeds up the fitment and the convenience of the disc. But when you're actually grinding, with a standard angle grinder, you have the locking nut which protrudes from the disc, so it probably sticks out about 1/2 inch. Now, when you're flat grinding, obviously that locking nut gets in the way, it interferes with the material, and sometimes it can damage the material that you are actually grinding, whether it's a surface weld or stainless or sanding wood. Because X-Lock is a keyless system, it doesn't have that additional locking nut. the actual disc surface is a lot flatter. So when you're coming to grind and taking off material, you'll get the actual grind on a flatter, more horizontal. So you will actually improve the quality of finish and get it done quicker.
Paul, that's great. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Toolfarer Professional Builder Live is bigger and better than ever in 2024, with 5 further shows at venues up and down the country. It's an event that puts tradespeople at its heart, with great show deals from the industry's best known brands, live demonstrations and seminars. Parking is free, and if that's not enough, there's a free bacon roll and Professional Builder t-shirt for every attendee. Check out all the dates and venues for Toolfare and Professional Builder Live at www.toolfare.info. You can read all about the Energy House 2.0 project in the April edition of Professional Builder magazine. So make sure you pick up a copy from your local builder's merchant trade counter or visit www.probuildermag.co.uk to view a digital version. In the meantime, thank you for listening.